They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
They call it the State of the Union, but really, it's more like the state of politics and partisan bickering. And tonight, the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. And by Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, everybody, January 28th, and it's good to have you with us. As happens every year on the day of the State of the Union speech, the White House lets some of the details slip out early. National security, free trade, the stimulus package, it's all there. But the president has also taken aim at something very nearly untouchable, at least if you ask the members of Congress sitting in the audience. He wants to crack down on legislative earmarks, but not until next fiscal year. From Washington Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
President Bush was fired up about earmarks in last year's State of the Union address, too.
So let us work together to reform the budget process and cut the number and cost of earmarks at least in half by the end of this session.
Republicans and Democrats applauded wildly. A year later, 2008 spending bills contained more than 11,000 earmarks, a pile of pork worth nearly $17 billion. Tonight, President Bush will announce he'll veto any future spending bills that don't cut earmarks in half. He'll sign an executive order tomorrow requiring government agencies to ignore most earmarks. But President Bush's proclamations tonight only apply to fiscal 2009 spending.
The president's not putting his neck on the line with this statement.
Ryan Alexander is president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. She says the president should have applied tonight's proclamations to this year's pork.
It's all actions that potentially another president is going to have to follow through on, and making promises for somebody else is a lot easier than making promises for yourself.
John Graham worked in the Office of Management and Budget under President Bush. He thinks the president is focused on future earmarks because that's the best way to make his tax cuts permanent. Another thing the president is expected to call for tonight.
He realizes that the future of his tax cuts hinge on a much better ability to control domestic spending.
And there's the rub. Congress doesn't like sacrificing its pork. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
If most consumers could get maybe 10% off their next big purchase, maybe even 20%, it'd get them spending, don't you think? Well, yes, unless the item in question is a new home. Builders of new houses cut those prices last month. Didn't do them a lick of good. The Commerce Department reported today sales fell to their lowest level in almost 13 years. That capped a record drop for all of 2007. It's tempting to say this has to be the bottom of the housing market, but we asked Marketplace's Bob Moon to find out whether there's any reason to believe that 2008 home sales will be any different.
The sound of new home construction has given way to a different kind of cutting lately. Builders of new homes especially have been making deep cuts in their prices.
I would strongly urge them to cut the cutting because it's only hurting your bottom line, not helping it.
Professor Edward Leamer keeps tabs on the housing market at UCLA's Anderson School of Management. He says it's obvious all the price cutting isn't working to lure badly needed customers.
It's having the opposite effect because it's creating on the part of buyers a sense that there are more cuts to come. Rather than stimulating sales, those price cuts are actually reducing sales.
And as long as prospective buyers sense prices could keep falling, they'll be reluctant to commit to a costly mortgage. So says economist Ian Shepherdson at High Frequency Economics. He's convinced what home builders need to cut even more aggressively is their production. And until they do, even another cut in interest rates by the Fed this week might not help much.
Everybody likes to borrow money to buy a cheap asset because they can make money on it. But nobody likes to buy a cheapening asset with borrowed money. And, of course, the banks are increasingly reluctant to lend.
It's all a vicious circle that Shepherdson has no reason to believe will end anytime soon.
My guess is that we could see sales dropping another 20% or so from here. And that would mean that from the peak, they could have dropped by something like two-thirds, which would be an absolutely enormous decline.
He says it took 3 years to recover from the last housing market recession of this size in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Unlike now, tight credit wasn't a problem back then, and he says that makes this downturn even tougher to turn around. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
If you have turned to the movies to get an escape from the economic real world, yeah, nice try. The show before the show just keeps getting longer, and it's not just previews. Big advertisers are moving from the small screen to the big one, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Movie theater ads are a $500 million business and growing around 15% a year.
For the ultimate ice cream experience, Cold Stone Creamery.
Yeah, our lead wants a Diet Coke.
Well, get it!
Okay.
Get me a Diet Coke right now.
TV, the traditional mecca for ad dollars, is losing ground. Norm Chade is senior vice president for ad buying giant MediaVest. It's considering moving $100 million ad dollars from primetime TV to the silver screen.
What prompted us was the continued ratings erosion in the traditional linear television marketplace.
Granted, $100 million is a sliver of the $9 billion primetime TV ad market, but it marks a sea change, says marketing consultant Bert Flickinger. He says TV is losing younger viewers to other media, like the internet, and recorders like TiVo mean ads often get skipped. Then there's the writer's strike, which means no new episodes of popular shows. Flickinger says the movies present an attractive alternative.
It's also a way to reach a consumer that typically has higher levels of disposable income and also reaches a younger consumer demographic.
Flickinger says another advantage of the movies is the captive audience. A bunch of young people sitting still, the holy grail of advertising. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
McDonald's offered a new special today, two all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, and a slowing economy. Slipping domestic sales cut into their profits. Investors had it their way, though, if I could mix my restaurant metaphors. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Some of the people who'd like to be giving the State of the Union speech next year have had to change direction lately and recast their messages to capitalize on a falling economy. We're going to be talking to campaign economic advisors this week. Today, it's David Malpass. He's a senior advisor to Rudy Giuliani. The former mayor of New York City got a boost in the early polls by saying he's strong on national security. Now he's become, to quote the mayor himself, the real fiscal conservative in the race. Mr. Malpass, good to have you here.
Hello, Kai.
I'd like to ask you about Mr. Giuliani's quote that I saw the other day about this stimulus package. He said, I would support it, but I don't think it goes far enough. What would he like to see in there that's not there?
He's looking for programs that really transform the economic outlook for the U.S., and so that includes a big change in the direction of tax policy. One of the things hanging over the economy right now is the idea that taxes are going to go up a lot in 2011 unless there's concerted effort in Washington to stop that. And he'd like to see the Bush tax cuts made permanent, but going farther, a further cut in the capital gains rates. Then on the corporate tax front, lowering the corporate tax rate to 25%, all of this designed to make the economy grow more. So as Washington's thinking about stimulus, they're thinking in a pretty limited sense about, you know, tax rebates this year. He'd like to go farther.
We'll get to the long-term plans that the mayor has for the economy in just a second, but I want to make sure I understand you right. He doesn't see any need now for short-term stimulus?
I think he's comfortable with the idea that Washington wants to work on this, also comfortable with the idea of more help on the mortgage side for homeowners. That's actually a critical part of the problem.
What would he do in terms of the housing industry and the wave of foreclosures that could hit this country in the next year, year and a half or so? How would he help those folks who are in danger of losing their homes?
Yeah. He's wanted to make sure that the laws that regulate the mortgage industry are enforced better. That's been one of the problems. Then also see some consideration of a tax credit or a deduction for people within their foreclosure problems.
The mayor is proud of saying that he's advocating the largest tax cut in American history. It's valued at several trillions of dollars, I believe. Do you think this economy is in a position right now to absorb those kind of tax cuts?
I do. As taxes go down, for example, on capital gains, as the mayor has proposed, you're going to get more people buying machines, building businesses, holding long-term capital gains because they wouldn't be taxed on the inflation. So that should be fixed within the tax code, and that will help economic growth.
The mayor's run very heavily on his track record as mayor, specifically in national security policy, but also in the last couple of weeks on his economic legacy in New York. It's one thing, though, to run a city, even a city as big as New York, and it's entirely another, don't you think, to run the largest economy in the world.
Well, New York is a huge economy by itself, and so he's had experience with one of the nation's big economic entities. But I think you have to go beyond that and look at Washington from the standpoint of can you pull together teams of people and lead in a concrete direction? In the economic direction, the mayor's strongly supportive of small businesses and of innovation, of entrepreneurism, of a changed energy policy for the country, a changed health policy for the country. So I think those two things go together, the experience and then a clear vision.
David Malpass is a senior economic advisor to the Giuliani campaign. Mr. Malpass, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
There's a link to more of my talk with Mr. Malpass and to those we're going to have with some other advisors online. It's marketplace.org. Here's a Craigslist want ad for you. Prestigious university seeks academic heavyweight to explore the internet's effect on mass culture. The listing is fake, but the job's not, thanks to a $1.6 million gift from Craigslist for an endowed chair at the University of California, Berkeley's new media center. Commentator Benjamin Barber says that is just the latest example of the line between private enterprise and public institutions getting a little too fine.
America is a nation of contrasts. Take Yale University. Sitting smack in the middle of downtown New Haven, Connecticut, the city has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the U.S. and a crumbling, underfinanced public infrastructure. Rusting bridges, rundown schools, leaking sewers, an antique port, and unfinished highways. As private money spent on private institutions like Yale grows, public money is vanishing. So cities like New Haven increasingly have to depend on private sector trickle-down. Yale's sinking over $400 million a year into what's going to be an Ivy League makeover. Meanwhile, New Haven's got about $137 million to devote in this fiscal year to its desperate infrastructural needs. So it comes hat in hand, begging the university to help revive the downtown commercial sector. It's a national trend. According to the New York Times, government spending for infrastructure has come down from 3.6% of GNP in the 1960s to 2.7% today. But New Haven's actually lucky. It's got Yale. What are nearby Connecticut cities like Bridgeport or Watertown supposed to do without Ivy League patronage? That's the riddle. Americans seem to have stopped believing in the very idea of a public good and regard taxation as theft rather than a means to common goals. How, then, can we salvage the national infrastructure? This is no theoretical question. Governor Schwarzenegger announced recently that he was prepared to slash public spending in wealthy California. Why? Because he refuses to raise taxes. So there it is. One America, private, wealthy, and hostile to taxation, willing to secede from the other America, public, poor, and dependent on taxation, which leaves citizens grabbing at crumbs falling from sumptuous private banquet tables, if they're lucky enough to live next door to a banquet table like Yale.
Benjamin Barber is at the New York City think tank Demos. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, one atmospheric scientist hatches a plan of oceanic proportions.
True freedom, when given a choice between A and B, is to create C.
But first, let's do the numbers. Hopes of further interest rate cuts send stocks higher on Wall Street today. The Fed meets tomorrow and Wednesday, in case you're curious. The Dow Industrial shot up 1.4%, 176 points, to close at 12,383. The NASDAQ climbed 1%, 23 points, to close at 2,349. The S&P 500 bounced 1.75% higher, also 23 points, to end the day at 1,353. Merck helped lead the Dow rally today. Shares of the pharmaceutical giant spiked up more than 3% ahead of its earnings announcement this Wednesday. Glassmaker Corning had a sparkling day, up 3.25%. Fourth quarter profits rose 11% on strong demand for glass used in flat-screen televisions and computer monitors. Mayor McCheese wasn't smiling today. McDonald's stock sank more than 5.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday, January 29th. In New York, the Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. The Federal Open Market Committee enters a two-day meeting on interest rates. Expectations are that rates will be cut again. And the Senate Budget Committee holds a hearing on the long-term budget outlook. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Over the weekend, the Chinese government promised to crack down on piracy. Yes, again, this time it's illegal music downloads. The Culture Ministry says it's going to do its darndest to control illegal file swapping. Starting at the end of this month, Beijing's promising tough new rules for companies wanting to do business online. Call it the Great Firewall of China, if you like. The prospect has investors a bit leery, so we've got Scott Tong on the line from the Marketplace Bureau in Shanghai to explain. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
Remind me what the buzz is over the Chinese internet and what has these investors so excited.
Well, I want to tell you about our intern, Edward, because he's a snapshot of what's going on here in China.
Okay.
Nice guy, just graduated from college, and he doesn't watch TV. He says TV stinks here in China, so he watches online video. And guess what he watches? He watches Jon Stewart. and that's the story of China. You have bad TV, and everybody is connected to the internet, and so there's this great opportunity, 210 million eyeballs here in China. The internet population is virtually tied with the U.S. internet population. And Chinese internet users are way ahead of Americans as far as social networking and blogging. So the big venture capital guys, names that you and I know, Sequoia Capital, Bain Capital, they're placing big bets on these websites, kind of the Chinese versions of YouTube.
What are they watching, these recent college graduates, besides, you know, John Stewart?
A lot of entertainment. A lot of sports. There is a famous boy band here in China called the Back Dorm Boys. So they're downloading and watching a lot of that on these websites. You're not going to be surprised to hear they watch a lot of the naughty stuff, too.
I'm shocked.
The big IT movie in China is Ang Lee's Lust Caution.
Mm-hmm.
And the regulators in China, they kind of snipped out 10 minutes of the lust, which people want to see. And so,
lots of caution, though. Not much lust.
Right. Heavy on the caution. And so people are downloading some of those clips so that they can watch that. And there's also politically sensitive stuff, that there are protests periodically in China, and that is what the regulators in Beijing are concerned about.
Which brings us, I suppose, to these rules that are going to come out. What do they say?
The online video websites, according to the rules, they have to be majority state-owned. The other part of it is these online video companies have to have comprehensive internal censorship going on. Now, the thing is, they already do that. One analyst says that he walked into one of these companies, and they have people who are just sitting in front of video monitors watching stuff that's on these sites and finding stuff to harmonize, as they say in China. The word that the president has talked about is the harmonious society in China. So when things get snipped out or changed or deleted from websites, they say it's been harmonized.
Harmonious maybe, but you have to wonder how profitable it's going to be. Are these rules going to sort of hurt the industry before it really gets going over there?
The people who watch this industry say it may be more bark than bite. It may be more to send a message to these websites to make sure their internal sensors work a little bit harder so that these are deemed clean enough, especially going into the Olympics this coming August. The question from the business side is this going to scare away some of the advertisers, which may scare away some of the venture capital investors? And I guess that's the thing about China. It's super high reward and super high risk. And the risk just went up a little bit.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in Shanghai. Thank you, Scott.
All right, Kai. Thanks.
We're all trying to cut our greenhouse gas emissions, and in some cases, what we're doing is working. But in the event it doesn't, and the planet does keep getting warmer, maybe it's time for Plan B, adapting to global warming. Ice caps and glaciers are melting and thinning at record rates, and even the most conservative projections for sea level rise would mean hundreds of billions of dollars in lost infrastructure. For the first installment of our series, Plan B, we go down to the coast of Sonora, Mexico, and a scientist with a plan to capitalize on all that melting ice. Sam Eaton reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Big ideas, the kind that change the world, often come from the oddest places. For atmospheric scientist Carl Hodges, that place was 6,000 feet above Mexico's coastal desert, south of the Arizona border. And his idea, if it works, could stop one of global warming's most serious threats, rising seas.
Alfredo, we're going to make a pretty sharp turn, and we're going to follow that water inlet, that river.
We fly along the coast of the Sea of Cortez and then bank inland. In recent years, entrepreneurs have transformed the dry desert below us into a network of saltwater lakes so large they're visible from space. They were built to grow shrimp. But the source of Hodges' inspiration isn't the shrimp farms. It's the giant man-made canal that supplies them with a constant river of seawater.
That one pumping station with four pumps is as big as many rivers in the world.
And that's what gave Hodges his eureka moment.
These shrimp farms between here and Guaymas, which is only 100 miles to the south, pump more than 20% of the ice melt of the Antarctic.
Hodges started crunching the numbers and came up with the total volume of water flowing from the world's thawing ice caps and glaciers.
At 4 o'clock in the morning, I thought, Jesus, that's not very much. I mean, I had this image of what it was and how much the sea level was rising, and I knew there was thermal expansion. And that's not very much. And then I realized, my God, we can stop sea level rise.
Especially with the right profit motive. Near the Mexican fishing village of Bahia de Quino, Hodges is experimenting with what he hopes will become the world's next big cash crop. What look like rice fields stretch in every direction, turning this patch of desert scrubland into a green oasis.
This is Salicornia bicolovi. And to be slightly modest, which I have propensity not to do at times, it's probably the reinvention of irrigated agriculture.
That's because it doesn't use a drop of fresh water. The only thing these plants need to grow is the desert sunshine and a daily soaking of seawater.
We'll pick out one that we want to play with, and we'll pull it up. Okay, here are seeds in the center, and each section, like a pinwheel with eight areas, will become a seed.
Those seeds are key to Hodges' vision. They pack as much high-quality vegetable oil as soybeans, making Salicornia an ideal biofuel crop, and a highly profitable one, especially if the fertile effluent from those shrimp farms we saw from the air is used as the irrigation source. Today, that water flows back into the Sea of Cortez, causing huge dead zones along the coast. But it's not the environmental damage that bothers Hodges. It's the wasted opportunity.
Why don't you take it inland, green the earth, make some money, and give a whole bunch of people jobs?
But for any of this to counter rising seas, another step has to be taken. All that seawater pumped inland has to stay inland forever. And this is where the big science comes in. Hodges drives me into the heart of the desert. We pass miles of abandoned farms. Agriculture is in retreat here as the vast underground aquifer has slowly been pumped dry. We stop at a deserted farmhouse at the side of the highway. Hodges is trying to get a sense of how far the water table has dropped, and an old well at the back of the house could hold the answer.
Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to drop a rock. Based on what we've been able to put down there with string, we don't think there's any water. But I'm going to listen really close. The rock is now going down, going. I didn't hear anything that sounded like water.
This well, and the hundreds of others like it, supply crucial data points for the most controversial part of Hodges' plan. He wants to use the drained coastal aquifers as giant storage tanks for the world's brimming oceans. Hodges says the process is not only safe, it would actually boost the remaining freshwater supply further inland. And he's got the science to back it up. The main obstacle, he says, isn't whether or not it can be done. It's whether the planet's 6.5 billion people are willing to think a little bit bigger when it comes to adapting to a warmer world.
We always have choices. One of my favorite authors is Robert Gruden, and he said, true freedom, when given a choice between A and B, is to create C. That's what we're doing.
In Sonora, Mexico, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
We've got some other thoughts about seawater as climate change salvation on our website. It's marketplace.org. Other stories in our series, Plan B, are there too. It's a co-production with the Center for Investigative Reporting.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, and a nostalgic one it is, Legos turned 50 years old today. The little plastic brick hasn't changed much since 1958, but its influence in popular culture sure has. There are 62 Lego bricks for every single person on this planet. Still, all those years and all those bricks haven't necessarily been kind to the company. Lego had to sell off its theme parks after it lost hundreds of millions of dollars trying to expand that brand. It is back in the black today, has been for a couple of years. It's also red and green and yellow and blue and all the other colors that they come in. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 176 points, 1.4%. The NASDAQ rose 23 points, 1%. The S&P 500 packed on 23 points, 1.75%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up tomorrow on the program in our series Plan B, a way to avoid the rising oceans. No, not moving to higher ground, but moving the ground higher.
In the past, people who were living here in Holland, they were very smart. They only built their houses where the sea level would never come.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.